Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Mindhunter. In the early 1970s, FBI agent John E. Douglas created and managed the FBI's criminal profiling program, now called the Behavioral Analysis Unit. Douglas began interviewing serial killers and other violent sex offenders at various prisons, including David Berkowitz, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, Charles Manson, and others. In the late 1990s, he formed a partnership with author and documentary producer Mark Olshaker called Mindhunter Incorporated. Together, they wrote numerous true crime books based on John's experiences in the field. One of their books, Mindhunter, Inside the FBI's Elite Serial Crime Unit, was the basis for the popular Netflix series of the same name. Author and Mindhunter, Mark Olshaker, joins me today on Murder Most Foul. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Jim.
So let's begin with your, because you are you're a writer. Have you always been a writer?
I guess I have been ever since I got out of college. I actually wrote in college, and then worked briefly in advertising, and then went to work for the Washington Bureau of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper. It was an exciting time. It was during the fall of Vietnam and Watergate, which I guess dates how old I am. Went on from there into making documentary films, and from there into writing books. So I've had kind of a varied career, but it seems to have generally revolved around detective stories of one kind or another, either criminal justice or my other field is public health, which is, of course, the other big detective story where I follow disease detectives who are trying to come up with the answers to some of the really life-threatening questions.
So that's kind of, if we ever have a pandemic, you know, you would probably be someone that people want to if we had the pandemic.
Well, absolutely. In fact, I'm currently working on a book with Dr. Michael Osterholm from the University of Minnesota called The Big One, Preparing for World-Altering Pandemics to Come, which is based to a large extent on what we've learned and what we haven't learned from COVID and a lot of the mistakes that we've made.
Great. Now, one of your longest, a lot of times authors get together, or authors and people in other occupations, certainly in this case of serial killers and murderers, it would be policemen or maybe attorneys and whatnot. So you formed a partnership, if you will, in quotation marks, with a very interesting man, John Douglas, who has since retired, I guess, sort of at least from media. And you guys came together and you formed something called, ultimately called Mindhunters Inc. And you also have written, I mean, I did print out your Wikipedia and the list of books with John goes on and on. So talk about how you met him, how you developed this relationship.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. Around the time that, I read Silence of the Lambs, as so many other people did. I was already a documentary filmmaker and a novelist. I'd published four novels, thrillers, and they had done quite well. So I was okay with that. And I had been doing some work, writing and production for the PBS science series Nova. And again, I read Silence of the Lambs, and I was intrigued by it, as so many people were. And I went to the the executive director of NOVA, Paula Apsell at WGBH in Boston. And I said, Paula, I read this book, Silence of the Lambs, and I understand they're making a movie of it. And if the movie is anywhere near as good as the book, I think it's going to be a big hit. I didn't know how big a hit it would be, obviously. And I said, why don't we do a film about the real people, the real profilers at the FBI Academy in Quantico, kind of a behind-the-scenes story about this. And in those days, early 90s, serial killers, profiling were not yet the big thing, but I thought it would be a really interesting subject. So I called the FBI and I said I'd worked for PBS and I'd like to come and talk to you about it. And this was before, as I say, it was a very popular, and they said, sure, come on. It was before 9/11, obviously, so security wasn't nearly as tight. And so what we did, myself and my longtime production partner, Larry Klein, we followed this group of profilers, the investigative support unit, and tried to come up with a good case that we could write about and then produce. And we've learned that the head of this group was a man named John Douglas, who really was the FBI's behavioral profiling pioneer. And he looked and dressed just like you'd expect your perfect FBI agent to be. He was very charismatic, and we were able to center a lot of the film around him. And as you know from your experience in Rochester, one of the primary cases in this film, which we called Mind of a Serial Killer, was Arthur Shawcross, who in the late 1980s was killing prostitutes and street people in Rochester, New York. In any event, the film came out. It did very well in the ratings. The FBI got a lot of more requests for profiling services as a result of the film. Every time it was on, we were nominated for a national Emmy. And then I don't know how long after the film was on, John called me and he said, "I'm getting ready to retire. Do you think anybody would be interested in my story?" And I said, "Well, I'm certainly interested in your story. Let's figure it out." So I wrote a proposal. Probably the smartest thing I did was call the book Mindhunter. John and I went to New York with my agent, and we made presentations to a number of publishers. We got several very good offers, ended up with Scribner, the division of Simon & Schuster. The book called Mindhunter became a bestseller, and we said, well, let's keep going. We've got many more stories to tell. And that's kind of how it all started. And I guess you could say over the years, it's been a tremendous collaboration between John and me. We joke that he's a detective pretending to be an author, and I'm an author pretending to be a detective. But we've gotten to the point where we can finish each other's sentences pretty well now. And he often teases me and says, you know, you make it sound like you were there at, you know, all of these cases and interviews. So, you know, I plead guilty to that.
Now, one of the things that I do, just this is for me, just as a person out there, a civilian, I'm always intrigued by co-authors, obviously. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they're both authors, you know, and they, you know, Woodward Bernstein or whatever, you know, they figure out how to work. Sometimes I've read that someone sends a chapter to someone and then they send it back, that kind of thing. Yeah. But those are both authors. So you are basically, he's the storyteller sort of, and mm-hmm. you're the scribe. I mean, is that sort of a, how do you look at the way you've been able to do this, and not just once, but multiple times?
Yeah, well, I guess the best way is that I'm kind of the Watson to his Holmes. I'm kind of telling the story of his career and the careers of the people around him. So I've become kind of a scribe or historian for the profiling program at the FBI. So yeah, John and I would always talk about each case, each thing he wanted to write about, and I would write it up with a voice that's not only his, but you know, it's like you have to create a unique voice for a book, because books don't sound like actual conversation any more than movies do. So each one requires its own special type of dialogue and narrative. So and we go back and forth on each thing until we feel like we've gotten it right. Since we're writing nonfiction, it's important not only to get the perspective that John and his colleagues would have at a case, but also to make sure that the facts are accurate. So we have a researcher, Ann Hennigan, who's worked with us for many years and who tries to get all the facts straight for us. If we don't remember, we go back through all the contemporary news accounts of each story. And again, just try to be responsible. And the other thing, Jim, that I'd like to stress is that even though one of our original inspirations was Silence of the Lambs, we try very hard never, ever to glorify the killer. These people are mean, they're evil, they're whatever you want to call them, and the victims are the ones that we try to personalize, humanize, as well as the detectives, the FBI profilers, the police officers, sheriffs, anybody, district attorneys, anybody who is working on behalf of the victims, because that is the sacred trust.
Now, he's still got some stories left in his head? Are you still?
I think so. I think, you know, we may do a few more. We're talking about starting a Substack column where we can sort of drill down into some of the things that readers have asked us about over the years.
You also, inspired by you and John, was the program. There was a Netflix program, had a couple of seasons. At first, I thought when I saw it, Mindhunter Inc. and Netflix, I thought it was again a series of documentaries. So then when I saw it, I said, cast? What do you mean cast? And then there's a list on Wikipedia, the cast. So this was, so who approached, you approach someone or someone approached you for that?
Well, ever since Mindhunter was published back in the 1990s, we've been approached at various times about television shows or series based on it. We've sold a lot of options over the years, and you know, you never know if anything's going to happen. And so this one actually had a long and kind of tangled history. Originally, Charlize Theron, the actress, became interested in it. She had her company collaborate with Fox 21 Television to buy it, and then somehow migrated over to HBO, and we thought maybe it would be made there. And then HBO bought another series called True Detective, so they didn't need us anymore. But David Fincher, the director and producer who was associated with it, really liked the idea, and he had some chops at Netflix because of his series. So David Fincher brought it to Netflix, and we never sort of knew what was going to happen with it. They kept talking to us about it. We kept talking to Charlize's company, and they said, well, it looks good. It looks good, but we don't really know. And then I got a phone call asking for our addresses so they could send us another check. And I said, okay, well, I guess it's for real now. And we've been very happy with it, Jim. It went for two seasons. We're still hoping for a third. There's rumors, but we don't really know what's going to happen with that. We love the actors, Jonathan Groff and Holt McCallany, who starred in it. And what David Fincher decided to do was create two characters who were based on John and his partner, Robert Ressler, when they, back in the 1970s, started doing the prison interviews, which led to the whole profiling program. And these characters are sort of based loosely on John and Bob. But what was interesting is the serial killers and violent offenders who they interviewed in prison, people like Ed Kemper and Charles Manson, people like that, they were portrayed as themselves in a very accurate way. And we're very happy with the series because even though the characters of the detectives, the profilers, are somewhat fictionalized, the spirit of the show, the spirit of what they've done, really coheres to what we've done in our books. And so there really is a larger truth to it. And I think anybody who watches the series really will get a good sense of what the early days of the profiling program and how it came about, how for the first time, profilers or people in law enforcement were able to correlate what was going on in the offender's mind before, during, and after the offense. And this became crucial in being able to profile and predict offender behavior when you don't know who the person, the unsub, as we call them in law enforcement, is, and you're trying to find out.
Well, and I just have to put in here because I know that like a lot of things, people think that it's bogus, or I don't know if bogus, but it's hocus pocus or whatever.
Oh, sure.
And if you really read, I mean, you know, don't go in there with a closed mind, because I've read a lot of books. I've had a couple of psychologists on my program talking about, you know, the mind in that. And in some cases, it's a miss. Something they, you know, they had him being white and he turns out to be African-American, something like that. But in the majority of cases, when done properly, it, as you say, when you're trying to find the person, not so much prosecute them, once you got them, you know, knowing what's going on in their mind, that's for the head shrinkers. But to track down who it could be when you don't know who it can be, it has indeed been very helpful. Now, I will point out to my audience, I always do, you got to get the books. Ladies and gentlemen, get the books, get the books, get the books. There are so many of them. I've picked up a couple along the route. And I like, again, there are books. A lot of them are, you do have anthologies, you're covering more than one serial killer. We have one here, just took it off my shelf, The Cases That Haunt Us. And what's
and if you want to know who Jack the Ripper really was, read that book.
There you go. I'm not, at Barnes & Noble, at Amazon, at your local library. But you do have a Lizzie Borden in here. We'll talk just briefly at the end about my connection to Lizzie Borden, but Lizzie Borden's in there. And if you can share with John, please, when the next time you talk to him, you know, hopefully he'll see this, that the Lizzie Borden, I read the Lizzie Borden section and it's just wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
No, it really is, because because I'm a Lizzieophile, I've read all the books. And either the books, they're just plain history. This happened, this happened, this happened. The legal end interviewed someone who did a mock trial with Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor as the judges at a law school, that kind of thing. So that's all interesting. But his take in here is like something you won't read anywhere else. Okay. Enough of smoke up somebody's whatever. Let us talk about a case that's dear to my heart. And I'm being a little facetious, of course, because it happened in my hometown of Rochester, New York, ultimately, although it does spread into a couple other places in New York State. And that's the case of Arthur Shawcross. And this happened in the late 80s, 88. I think he might have been caught in 88. But briefly tell us, because he does have this wide, you know, it starts when he's young, and then there's, of course, there's a stop. He stops. Well, because he's in prison. And then, of course, he gets out and starts again. So, and again, this was the case that you picked to make your wonderful Nova or at least it was part of that, that Nova, a good chunk of it. You did a couple of other ones in there. So tell us your memory. I know it's a long time ago, but tell us what you remember about Arthur Shawcross.
Well, it starts out in the late 80s, as you say, Jim, and a series of prostitutes and street people, homeless people, all women, were being killed, strangled, and stabbed and all that. And this was really terrorizing the community, as you might expect. And they kept finding more bodies, and this was a horrible thing. Greg McCrary, one of John's teammates on in the Behavioral Science Investigative Support Unit at Quantico, was asked by the Rochester police to profile him. And he went up to Rochester, looked at the crime scenes, and one of the things he realized was that some of the bodies were that they found had been mutilated in some way. And from this, Greg determined that what was happening was that the offender, the unsub, as we call him, was returning to the dump sites to have some kind of interaction with the corpses. He came up with a profile of what kind of person this would be. He said he would be about 30 years old. He would have some experience. He would be a blue-collar type worker with a spotty record of work, all kinds of things. And he said, and the way you have a good chance of catching him is if you can find a body that and not publicize that it's been found, and you surveil that site, there's a good chance that the offender will come back and you can arrest him. And that's exactly what happened. They found this man, Arthur Shawcross, coming back to one of the dump sites in the Genesee River Gorge, which is where he was. And that's the other thing, dumping the bodies where he did. Greg said, well, this is somebody who has an intimate knowledge of the area. So this is a local person, and he's probably already interacted with the police. He probably hangs out at police establishments trying to get information, which all turned out to be true. The one thing that Greg got wrong about Arthur Shawcross was he was not 30 years old. He was 45. Now, this is very interesting because it turns out Arthur Shawcross had been accused and convicted of killing two young children, a boy and a girl, and the girl he also sexually assaulted. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison. God knows why, only 25 years for a crime that heinous. But he was paroled after 15 years, And so this guy had just been put on ice and just picked up where he left off. So even though he was 45 years old, he had the criminal sophistication of a 30-year-old, shall we say. And he just kept picked up right where he'd left off. He had been sent to Binghamton, New York, I believe it was, after he was paroled. The community there wouldn't accept him. He was then sent to Rochester, which was a bigger community. He became a salad preparer for a food service company, and within a few months went right back to killing. Now, what's interesting is he didn't go back to killing children. He went back to killing prostitutes and street people. What's the connection? The connection is that they're both very vulnerable. Prostitutes have to take strangers. Street people don't have any choice. They can be approached that way. And so this is, people think that, well, you have a victim of preference, and some serial killers do. Others will take whoever is available. And if you see Arthur Shawcross, he is fortunately no longer with us, but he was not exactly the most attractive person, so he was going to take whoever he could get. Now, the next interesting part of the story is that he confessed to police fairly quickly. two really excellent detectives, Len Borriello and Dennis Blythe, and they had an open and shut case. So the only defense was insanity. And he claimed that he was in sort of a fugue state when he did this. And there was a real battle of the shrinks between Dorothy Lewis of Yale and Bellevue and Park Dietz, who is a very prominent forensic psychiatrist who for many, many years has testified mainly for the prosecution. And Lewis claimed that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam. He'd never been in combat, by the way, and from abuse from his mother when he was younger, that he was a multiple personality disorder victim. What's interesting is we've seen solid evidence of young children, pre-verbal children, who do have multiple personality disorders from sexual abuse. I've never seen it in suddenly appear in an adult. It seems like post-arrest or sometimes even now, post-conviction.
Now, one of the things want to add that is from another like I said, I've looked up a lot about Arthur in preparation for this, and I just think it is brilliant that the two policemen you mentioned, two detectives or detectives and sergeant, whatever their titles were, that they questioned him for a long time, and they were working on again. And this we've seen it in Law and Order, where you either good cop, bad cop, all that kind of stuff. And in this case, they both they were very calm, and they tried to again win him. You want a cup of coffee. You want this, you want that. There's videos of his, representation of his questioning, and how the last key after they got him really comfortable, they thought, was to try to play to whatever he had, any feelings he might have, and not. So they brought up that the police didn't want to charge his girlfriend, Claire, I believe her name was. And because it was her car he was driving. Now, that would never, they weren't interested in that. They weren't going to do that. But they thought, let's see if, and I guess at that point, now maybe he was going to do it anyway. At that point, that was the last straw for him. And he said, okay, I'm going to confess.
Jim, I think police interrogations are fascinating. I mean, some of them can be very abusive. We've written about several cases, for instance, the West Memphis 3 case, or where detectives have kind of railroaded people into confessions by suggesting things. But Blythe and Borriello were excellent. And the other one this reminds me of is I had lunch several years ago with Tom Lang, who was one of the detectives, along with Phil Van Adder, who did the first interview with O.J. Simpson. And I said, and they were very cordial. Simpson was very cordial. I mean, there was no real tension in this interview. And I said, Tom, when did you become convinced, since this was so early on in the investigation, that OJ was the killer? And he said, this was a horrible crime. People knew it at that point. And OJ not once asked, well, what happened to her? What was it like? Did she suffer? I mean, what? In other words, he had no interest whatever in finding out what happened, which meant he already knew.
So, Mark, let's take a slight detour because this does fascinate me as well, and I know you've covered it. What is the explain the difference between a serial killer and a mass killer? The shooting up schools, etc.
Well, I mean, people talk. We have an epidemic of mass shootings, mass killings in this country, and people ask me and say, well, are these like serial killers? And no, they're not. For one thing, a serial killer, by definition, is a successful killer, somebody who has done it enough times so that they know what they're doing. They learned from their own behavior. They've learned from their own mistakes, and they try to get away with it. We've found, by and large, mass murderers are not looking to get away. This is an end game for them. They are not doing it over and over again. Whatever their grievance, whatever is going on in their mind, most of them do not expect to get away. I mean, they would hope to, but they don't expect. Often you'll find they kill themselves, or they set up what we call a suicide by cop. It's a completely different phenomenon. Generally, a mass killer has some kind of perceived grievance. Now, the one thing where we would make a connection is these are people, whether you're talking about the serial killer or the mass murderer, these are people who feel a certain entitlement. They feel a sense of deep feeling, and this is in conflict with a deep-seated sense of inadequacy, and this is all triangulated by a sense of resentment that society is not giving them what they deserve. So they feel entitled in their way to do what they do, justified, if you will. And in the case of mass murderers, and you go all the way back to Dylan Klebold in Columbine outside of Denver, which was the first of the big school shootings that we all recorded. There was a sense, well, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory, and this will fulfill me.
So again, in most cases, to stop them is, you know, we can have all the red flags. We've now seen the trial now going on. I've got the guys, Crumley. And his parents now are, you know, being the mother was being tried, and the father will be tried later for their, you know, connection to negligent manslaughter. But so they're not going to be shrunk because they're caught either, or they're dead. But it's the Ted Bundys, it's the people who go across the country, the Golden State Killers and Boston Strangler and all that do one, you know, do more than one. This is profiling is obviously incredibly important to catch them. After that, to figure out, you know, is there anything that could ever have been done for them or to society? And that's, again, for
Sigmund Freud. Also profiling can be used to figure out prosecution strategies too, which happens in a lot of cases. In the case of Wayne Williams, the Atlanta child murderer, John was consulted by the prosecution about how you can get to this guy. He seems very mild-mannered. He seems very reasonable. What can you do to get to him during the trial if he testifies, to show the jury what he was really like? And that's what he decided in his own arrogance to take the stand, and that allowed the prosecutor to really drill down and show him for what he really was.
Again, at this point, ladies and gentlemen, all I can say is you got to get all the books. Okay, I could do another hour with Mark, but unfortunately, he has other appointments, so I'm going to let him go. But I am going to, again, direct everybody. First of all, like I said, I the Shawcross thing is
amazing. And you deal with that case in Mindhunter.
Yes. Okay, so again, you get the case is there. What is the name? Because I YouTubed it, and I can't remember what title I put in. What title did you put in to get the NOVA thing? Do you know what was the NOVA program called?
That was called Mind of a Serial Killer. And our latest couple of books, we have one out about the actual process of interviewing these serial offenders in prison that led to the profiling program. It's called, appropriately enough, The Killer Across the Table. And then we've drilled down on a couple of individual cases that we talked about in Mindhunter, but did complete books about. One is called The Killer's Shadow, which is about Joseph Paul Franklin, the first serial killer who killed not for sexual reasons, but for racial reasons. He hated black people and Jews, and went across the country very successfully as a sniper, and killing people who offended his racial ideas. And then we have another book called When a Killer Calls, about the murder of Sherry Smith in Columbia, South Carolina, probably the most emotional case that John was ever involved in. It was a perfect example, which is why we wrote about it, of profiling, forensic science, and just really good detective work all coming together to catch a serial killer early in his career. That was called, as I say, When a Killer Calls. Very emotional case. I won't say anything more about it to spoil it, but I think it's one that we've gotten very good response.
Now, I can't let you go because my background, aside from playing with podcasts, is the theater. Mm-hmm. And I even see behind you, my audience can't see it, but you've got a Patrick Stewart poster there, A Christmas Carol, that he did a one-man show of.
And I think the one above that is Waiting for Godot, which he did in London.
Yes, with, oh my Ian God. McKellen. So he is, just why we're talking about this, he is the narrator of the NOVA program, and does a wonderful job. And how did you cut? Was he just hired by the production company? Or did you?
No. This was an interesting story. In 1988, I was doing a film about the theater, about the creative process of drama in Birmingham, England, called which we ended up calling Discovering Hamlet. And it was about the first time a young British actor named Kenneth Branagh had played Hamlet professionally, and he was directed by his own theatrical hero, Derek Jacobi, who had been a famous Hamlet in his own right at the Old Vic, and he also played Hamlet in the BBC production. Now, Derek and I had gotten to know each other quite well because I had done a series of animated films in London, and he had provided the voices for many of the characters. And I was having dinner with my wife, and I were having dinner with Derek in London one night, and I said, "Have you ever thought of directing?" And he said, "Well, funnily enough, I'm scheduled to direct with this company formed by this young actor, Kenneth Branagh, who I'd never heard of at that point. And we're going to take it to start at the Birmingham Repertory Theater." And I said, "Wow, that's fascinating. I'd like to come over and see it." Subsequent to that, I saw a production that Ian McKellen did called Acting Shakespeare. And I thought, gee, I'd love to do something like this about the creative process. So I then called Derek at home one Sunday afternoon and said, "What would you think if I tried to do a film about this production?" And he said, "Well, it's okay with me. You know, I'll talk to Ken and see what he thinks." And fortunately, we were able to raise enough money to do it. It was not an easy sell. So we did this. We did this production about the creative process. So many films, you know, will tell you, you know, we start where all the others, you know, end, and we say no. We end where all the others start, because we start from the first morning of rehearsal and end when Ken walks on stage on opening night. But in any event, some of the people that I used as advisors, one in particular, Homer Swander from the University of California at Santa Barbara, said, "Well, you've got to meet Patrick Stewart because he'll be really interested in this." And I sort of vaguely knew who he was from Star Trek. He, you know, it had been a couple of seasons at that point. And so Patrick happened to be in London when we were there. And Homer, who was called Murph Swander, arranged for us to have lunch together. And Patrick said, "Look, if I can do anything to help you with all this, you know, I'd be happy to." And I said, "Well, you could narrate it for us." And he said, "Okay." And so Patrick and I just became really good friends, and we've become close friends ever since. And it's a he's a wonderful guy. He is very generous and a very talented actor, very sensitive. And so when it came time for to do Mind of a Serial Killer, I said, you know, this would be an interesting thing, an English voice narrating this. So I said, would you do this one? And he said, okay.
You know, did you recreate the rehearsals or?
No. We this was all
done when it was. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It wasn't from, I mean, it was
yeah,
3 weeks.
Yeah, so, I mean, rehearsal was 5 weeks. Obviously, we had to be judicious in our filming because otherwise we would go way over budget. And so we, you know, we picked days when we thought that there would be good stuff. And, you know, we had to work those 5 weeks down into a 1 hour film. And so the big challenge for me was how to tell this story. I mean, because we're talking several stories at the same time. So how do you tell the story of the rehearsal and tell the story of Hamlet for people who don't know, particularly school children, at the same time? So what I came upon was I decided, all right, well, the early scenes in the film, the early scenes in the play, we'll show early parts of the rehearsal, and we will progress through the rehearsal as we tell the story of the play itself. And that seemed to work quite well. And let me just interject here, Jim, that Ken referred to the film, to the play, as a thriller. It's a mystery and a thriller. And we reacted to it on that level. So it's kind of of a piece with what I've done for most of my career.
And the murders. There's murders,
yeah,
okay?
Exactly.
Murders. I mean,
quite a few.
You can't ask for anything more but murders. I'm going to ask you one last question about behind the curtain, if you will, and this may not make it, but it is an interesting question for me. You wrote the narration for Patrick Stewart. Who decided the question, because we never hear questions in it, I don't think, in the Nova piece. Just there's a lead in by the narration, and then the policeman or whoever it is speaking. Who wrote, did you write those questions?
Yes, I wrote and asked them. And, it's a pretty common interview technique in this kind of film where you say to the subject, I'm going to ask you questions, but please don't answer them as questions. Answer them as statements, because you're not going to hear my voice and all that. So and every once in a while you have to say, okay, Len, that was great, but could you do it in the form of a statement rather than a question again? So yeah, that's how we did it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, that's just for my knowledge, again, because my, experience with it is very similar to that the producer, who is usually a host of a program, would come out with us. And, you know, it wasn't the biggest stories in the world. It was public television, but they'd be interviewing a chef or something. And it was clear, right, that they were not in the, there were others where you're part, the person over the shoulder shot, and they're part of the scene. But in those, a lot of them, because they knew that's how they were going to chop it up and narrate it, that it was just, okay, how do you make the pizza? And so I said, how do you make pizza? No, you got to just go into it, because the question is not there. This has been so much fun. So I did want to ask you, is Across the Table, the way you're running through books, is that
the
out?
Killer Across the Table. Yes, Killer Across the Table.
Is that out already?
There, it is out, yes, and so is The Killer's Shadow, and When a Killer Calls. You see, killer is a fairly common trope in what I write, as well as the one you mentioned earlier, The Cases That Haunt Us, where we take a number of cases, starting with Jack the Ripper, going all the way up through JonBenet Ramsey, and say these are cases that were never really solved or satisfied to the public's or law enforcement satisfaction. So what can we say, taking a deep dive in them from both a forensic and a behavioral point of view, and we try to solve them. I think in the case of Jack the Ripper, we actually named who it was. The case of the JonBenet Ramsey case, we couldn't say who it was, but we could say who it definitively was not, which was the parents. And John and I got a lot of pushback from this. I mean, we were very unpopular, even with the FBI, when we said this. But I think our reasoning and our logic is ironclad on that. Unfortunately, Jim, this is very common. We did a book called Law and Disorder. I have the paperback here, where we talked about cases that we thought had been badly adjudicated, where innocent people had been convicted. When we wrote about the Amanda Knox case in Italy, we absolutely showed how she and her boyfriend, Rafael Celestino, could not possibly have had anything to do with the case. And we showed in every way. And yet, to this day, there are still all the haters and all the people. And even people that I've talked to will say, yeah, well, I see what you're saying, but I still think she had something to do with it. And I say, where's your evidence? I said, I've presented all of the evidence that it couldn't possibly have been her, just as we did for the Ramseys, and just as we did for the West Memphis Three. So, you know, you may have your own feelings about it, but we're evidence-based. And this is common, and the old cliche, you know, the haters are going to hate, is still operable and always will be, I suppose.
All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I could go on for hours, but I think the best thing to do is, of course, although this took many weeks to set up, Mark is very busy. I know I will be back because I'm going to be reading some more of these books. So aside from, again, just putting your name in Google or going to Amazon, it's MarkOlshaker, all shaker. And
John Douglas is my partner.
And John, we don't want to forget John E. Douglas in Wikipedia, mm-hmm. is the partner and the man with the stories. Right. I'm assuming is there a website for you yourself? Or
we're actually redoing our website now. So just go on Google or
just
whatever.
Google and
Amazon has all our books. And so
and all the books. Buy all the books. Most of them.
Thank you. God bless you, Jim, for saying that.
No. Listen to me. They're, first of all, most of them are in paperback now. I don't know if they first came out in hardcover.
I think they all are at this point, yeah.
At the paperback, and I'm sorry, you know, $6, $8, $10, come on. This is my own soapbox, though. If you're going to do it, if you have an opportunity to use a brick-and-mortar store, please do that. We have many in Rhode Island, many small bookstores, and if they don't have it, they can get it for you. You may spend $2 more, but you're supporting that
business.
We're
big fans of independent bookstores, no question.
I've done Amazon. I have to if at times I can't get it anywhere else. But I think that when you have an option, and certainly use your libraries. Yep. I want a book in my hand. My wife does Kindle. I won't do Kindle.
My wife does Kindle and I don't.
One last thing I want to throw out there before we go. You were talking about the various cases that you and John covered that you got pushback on from the public. Now, I've had a few of my podcasts getting some pushback, and it's kind of odd because I just have guests on. I mean, but they attack me. But I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm putting forth an interesting author or person who's going to tell their story. And it is sad now, though, that we just can't seem to agree on what the truth is.
Yeah, and I think that's very true, Jim. And this is something we certainly, with the internet and with cable television, everybody has their own reality now. I mean, we don't all agree on the same things. And in fact, what's interesting is, you know, I mentioned that I had worked for early in my career for the Washington Bureau of the St. Louis Post Dispatch during Watergate and the Nixon resignation, and a college student came to me and said, well, what's different now? This was during the Trump administration, said, what's different between Watergate and the Nixon administration and what's going on now with the Trump administration? And I said, well, I think the main difference to me is everybody was, it was a very divisive time during Nixon's term in office, but everybody kind of agreed on the same facts. We had three networks, we had newspapers everywhere in every city, and you had your own opinion on them, but we didn't disagree on what had actually happened. Now, with the internet, with cable news, with all of these podcasters, with all of the bloggers, with everything that's going on, with all the influencers, nobody agrees on a set of facts, and that's really difficult. So it's hard to agree, if it's hard to agree on what reality is, it's hard to agree on anything.
I want to thank Mark Allshaker for joining me today on Murder Most Foul.
Thank you for having me, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So, until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.